Today we're going to talk about the Heritage Act as an example of colonialism, of contemporary colonialism. There we go. Part of way of doing this is that one of the reasons why I want to talk about the Heritage Conservation Act of British Columbia and the way it links to colonialism is this is one of the front lines of interactions between Indigenous communities and industrial development in British Columbia. Whether you're trying to build a private mansion on a small island on the coast somewhere, you are doing a fracking project in the northeast of BC and you want to actually get your underground rights in place, you're doing a pipeline across the northern British Columbia, you are installing a run-of-river project in the Fraser River drainage somewhere, you are doing a housing development in a major urban center. Doesn't matter. You will, whether you realize it or not, come into encounter with the Heritage Conservation Act, and that automatically, based upon the policies and the regulations tied to the Heritage Conservation Act, bring into the picture First Nations. And the reason, of course, that does is, as we've discussed in this course, under Canadian law, the Crown has a fiduciary responsibility, a duty to consult, and to consult in a fairly significant manner. And the reason why they have to do this is because Aboriginal rights and title are affirmed under the 1982 Constitution of Canada and have been documented and elaborated through a sequence of legal court decisions. So that's why, and this is where this often, as you say, the pedal hits the metal, or something else. So, four things I'm going to talk about, in not in equal proportion. British Columbia's archaeology branch, that's the agency that's mandated to manage and control the process around heritage values. I'm going to talk about two particular flashpoints. I previously mentioned these. Down around the foot of Arthur Lang Bridge, part of the Musqueam community, Grace Islet over in the Vancouver Island. Then we're going to explore what I call colonialism in action, taking a look at forestry archaeological surveys on the north coast, and then LNG and port development as two particular linked examples, and then consider part of the counterpoint perspective of how this might or should look if an Indigenous community was able to activate the strategic value and strategic possibilities of their rights and title. So if you do a search for Archaeology BC, Archaeology Branch BC, you find this rather nondescript looking page in the government website. This is the central repository of archaeological related policy information procedures in BC. The archaeology branch is currently under the Ministry of Forest. Oh, there we go. Ministry of Forest, Lands, and Natural Resource Operations. The branch itself has bounced around from one ministry to another. To actually plot the history of these different government agencies is far more complex than it really should be. But often, depending upon political orientation, visions of particular prevailing governments, particular agencies and branches get shifted around, and ministries even get changed and form and broken down. If you take a look down the side here, you see this little description. Here we are, archaeology in British Columbia there. We have ideas on processing requests for archaeological site records, because as a member of the general public, you have no right to see any of this information. Unless you want to request specific information, say, about your property. So say you've got a house, just for example, going down to Spanish Banks, on the edge of University Endowment lands, there's a big, long, green patch that's open there. I don't know if anyone knows who that is. No? So walk out this door, go straight down to Lorimar Gulch, straight toward the Museum of Anthropology. Turn right, walk down fourth, or with the Northwest Marine Drive there. Turn left once you pass Green College down to go to the beach. You swing past a bunch of deciduous trees to your left, some gigantic houses to your right. The road swings, there's a cairn, a stone commemorating some World War II housing. Keep going down that hill, and there's an open patch on your left in the water side, big lawn. Somewhere in the 30s, 40s, or 50s, I forget where exactly, it was a children's camp playground. That is a Musqueam village. Now just say, perchance, that you happen to own that property, and I'm putting quotation marks around the word own, yes? That's right, before you get to the little parking lot that's halfway down Spanish Banks Hill, that's, yeah. So this is a village. Now say you, as I say, quote unquote, owned it, and you're going to build a house there, beautiful view, vantage point, of course, in order to do that, you probably have a fair bit of resources in hand, because that's not actually a cheap piece of land if it was privately owned. And you might think you can just call off the backhoe and start digging. Now, sadly, a lot of people do that. They just call up the backhoe and start excavating. Technically, you're not supposed to do that. You have to do an assessment. But also, before you even go to the assessment point, you're supposed to get the legal folks who you bought the land from, the lawyers who are working with you, to do a search and a check to see on the conveyance when they transfer the property back and forth whether there is a heritage site recorded there. That's when you call up the archaeology branch. It's not recorded actually on the land title, because the data in the archaeology branch is so problematic in some of its geo-referencing material that it actually, especially for the older recorded sites, you have to physically go there and check out where the so-called legal site boundaries are. But you're supposed to do that. And to do that, of course, to do this investigation, before you even stick anything into the ground, you need a permit. And that's all regulated by the province of British Columbia. And that's what the archaeology branch is about. The thing is that this is, in the urban areas, interesting enough, this is less understood than in the rural industrial areas. So the forest industry, the mining industry, is pretty well aware of it. And if they're not aware of it, it's either because and this is going to be a very rude comment, it's either because they're stupid or they're deliberately ignoring it. Because in the industry, it's pretty well set that you have to get these kind of permits. And there's different, when I say stupid, I mean it, of course, tongue-in-cheek. Sometimes people just really don't pay enough attention. They kind of think they can just jump over it. There's been cases, nothing particularly recently, where guys doing small business logging operations kind of think there's a pile of crap to worry about when you've got a bunch of cured rocks on the beach and somebody's called it a canoe skid. They think, what the hell does that mean? And they start blasting to put the log dump on the site. And for them, they see it as a sequence of dollars in interruption. But it does have an impact, except, of course, in the Ministries Act, the biggest fine you can get is $2,000 or a six-month jail term. So you can go to jail for a violation of the Heritage Conservation Act. But I really, when I'm asking around, I can't think of any people who've actually gone to jail, at least not in recent memory. There have been occasional fines, but even in some of the more recent egregious examples of violating permit procedures, etc., there have apparently been no fines issued. So that's an interesting side fact, side point to this. I just want to talk about a couple of these flashpoints. Well, I call them flashpoints. All up and down the coast, all through the interior of BC, there are indigenous sites, sacred sites, habitation sites, resource harvesting sites, transportation routes that are being disrupted. Very few of those actually hit the news, unless it involves human burials. Because human burials does affect, it's a particular, some of the, in communities, people are particularly concerned to stand and fight and resist the disruption of a human of cemeteries. But also it's something that seems to catch the imagination of the wider non-Indigenous community as well. So it creates an avenue for connection. an argument about the value of maintaining what appears to be a 20-foot deep sort of terrace that's predominant value as a historical point and fish bones doesn't capture the same kind of public imagination, even though I wish that it would. I mean, we have a lot of village sites that look like nothing to the outsider. They don't have any monumental poles left on them or things like that. But what they do have is a material reference to a detailed, long-lasting history. Grace Islet, you can see right here, and it's not particularly well. You see, it's a tiny little island. It's a beautiful place if you've got the money to build a house, a beautiful vantage point. You see this machine right in here, this yellow and black small little excavator. What they're doing, and this is in site preparation for building the house, is digging up all the soil on the surface in between the stone burial cairns. So I believe there's something like 15 to 20 burial cairns identified on this island. And what a burial cairn is human remains encased within a rock structure. It's like a tomb. If you were to walk through the cemetery in the center of Vancouver, there are certain parts of it where you actually have kind of mausoleum-like structures and different memorial markers fixed and solidly in place. That's what this is. So what had happened here is that the archaeologists who came and did the initial assessment of the site basically said there was nothing of significance here, which was a kind of curious fact. They made some notations, but essentially their recommendation was the house could be built and would not cause any significant disruption. An archaeologist happened to be going by when an excavator was on site. I believe this is one of the pictures that comes from this point. He called up the people afterwards. Anyway, he was going by, saw this, tried to figure out what the heck was going on because he knew what was on this place. Saw them digging it up and called in the nearby First Nations community that he was connected to in terms of his employment and works, and they came and took a whole sequence of pictures. And this led to a process where by now Grace Islet was purchased by the provincial government to be set aside. And they purchased from the individual who actually had bought the land some years ago. Imagine, if you will, taking a backhoe. So just imagine if a crew from Musqueam, just to make it even more inflammatory perhaps, crew from Musqueam went up across from John Oliver High School and decided it was going to build a community building in that middle of that cemetery. It just said, well, don't worry, nothing's going to happen. We're just going to dig out, sink the foundations. We're going to dig in between the graves. And we'll leave the graves. We're not going to disturb them. We're going to put the proper little boxes to protect them over them. And they build some very rough-hewn chunks of plywood and 2x4s around some of the grave sites. A couple of them, they pour in some concrete where the forms have split open. So you see the concrete kind of bubbling around and rough-hewn like that. And say, just go ahead. What do you think the response would be? That's more of a rhetorical question. What do you think people would say in Vancouver? I mean, I don't even know if the backhoe would get into the ground to start digging. Can you imagine? That's what's happening here. Now, Stensnum is another location. This is a Musqueam location, down by the Arthur Lang Bridge. And a family had owned a chunk of land for a period of time and had been buried by a covered over top with a parking lot, some other building structures. It had been an industrial site off and on. Again, the archaeological assessment that was tied to the site said basically there was nothing of significance here. Anything that was has been disturbed. And therefore, i.e. disturbed means you can do more. Doesn't matter. It's kind of an interesting idea that if you've already disrupted and desecrated the site, the location, the language in the Act and the policy allows you to actually, it diminishes its value. Midway through the initial assessment, it was revealed that there was, I believe, two or three fully intact human beings interred in this site, buried, it says. And it led to a widespread community, a Musqueam-led protest that was linked into the wider urban community. And eventually, Musqueam, with their own funds, purchased this land from the owners, the developers, for some money, and then are now moving to change the nature of how this site's dealt with. A little bit earlier on in history, Musqueam bought the Fraser Arms Hotel. Fraser Arms Hotel as well, to also try to put an end to digging up the underlying village site, which is a very, very large village, which in the archaeological language is referred to as the Marpole Midden. Of course, the problem with the word midden is midden sounds like garbage dump. And in fact, if you look at the etymologically speaking, what the root of the word midden is, midden really is an inappropriate and offensive word to use to refer to sacred spaces, their village locations, etc. Now, these type of events attract attention, and one of the things that they highlight is the extensive amount of the high degree of discretion that the government's representatives, the way the act has established the Heritage Act, that the minister responsible has authority for making decisions. The minister delegates that to the head of the archaeology branch, who's given certain criteria of evaluation to make decisions about issuing permits to destroy sites, issuing permits or orders to stop work, etc. But there's a high degree of discretion built into that structure. And when a First Nations community raises a concern, you don't know when the minister's designate will actually respond to the concern by changing the archaeological investigation or assessment permit, and whether they will allow for what's often called a mitigation protocol, which mitigation is a kind word, a kind of a cleansed word to mean destroy and remove. So mitigation, how do you to mitigate an adverse impact? Often in these languages, these reports, mitigation means how are you going to structure the removal or destruction of a particular site, a particular location. So I'm going to talk a little bit now, move from these. Yeah, go for it. Question. Grace Island, no, sorry. Yes, the development did not continue, and the individual who owned it eventually had it was sold, and I can't remember the particular, if it was I believe the provincial government funded the purchase of it, or else it's going to go into a land conservancy thing, but it has been preserved. Of course, one of the problems with doing that kind of piecemeal preservation of these very tiny specific places is that it does not provide a consistent or long-term resolution of these issues, but merely reinforces the kind of ad hoc aspect of the process. So in one case, Grace Islet, you save the little place, but this location here, see all those colors? That's up in Prince Rupert Harbor. That entire place has been raised with a Z, which means like obliterate, to the bedrock. And of course, because it was in the way of development, and they had to put a train line down there, and why should you preserve an old abandoned village site? Let's excavate it all and digitize it and record it and analyze it. It was completely removed. This is one of two major sites in recent years that this has happened to. It's hard to find it, and it pops up and down on Facebook. There was a digitized image of George MacDonald's footage from the 1970s of them building what, when we grew up in Rupert, we called the Superport. I love the way words are. It was like a big cement pad for the first near the entrance to the Prince Rupert Harbor. This is now they're expanding that old port, turned into a big container ship port, and they're moving it as a major conduit from goods, raw resources out to Asia and goods from Asia into the center of North America. MacDonald filmed, and this is how several thoughts tumbling around here in the head at the same moment. So I'll be clear. So what we have made some improvements. So today you go and obliterate the site by you send in a team, you work for 4 or 5 months, and you dig everything up, and you do a rigorous scientific sampling of materials, and you put in a laboratory and sort it, etc. In the early days, in the 70s, the way you did it is you ran a bulldozer through the site, and you had your archaeologists scrambling in front of the the blade of the bulldozer, picking out the human bones, the skulls, the femurs, the tibias, etc. And it's true. It's in the picture. You can see it. I'm not. This is not some kind of, you know, sort of urban university professor hyperbole. It actually is the way it was done. And they managed to stop it for a little bit, but they basically did this excavation in front of the backhoe, dug in a shovel backhoe, spilled it out. This is when they were doing it slow, dumped it down on a tarp, sorted through, looking for the big things, and then on they went. It's a destructive and despicable practice that actually still continues in a modified fashion. So with the whole ring road expansion that occurred through here with the, I forget what they was called, the Fraser Gateway Road, etc. Part of the mechanisms for monitoring is you have a couple archaeologists, or one or two archaeologists, maybe a community, a representative from the community as, or nearby First Nations community as observer. You're trenching for putting in some, either for conduit of some sort, or you're excavating for the roadbed, and you actually have somebody checking each shovel load, initially every, sampling every shovel load to make sure when you start to run into something. Of course, now the provision is when you hit something, you're supposed to stop. And so that's the improvement. But these are all permitted and approved in the occurring. Now, one of the issues here, one of the points, is that in this process, the state is actually implicated and entwined within a patriarchal and colonial process. So we get a bit of a kind of paradox, because if we rely upon the state as it's currently configured to act as a quote-unquote neutral arbiter, we face a problem. So the Act, the Heritage Act, is written to presume, it's written from the assumption the state is neutral and stands above contesting parties. Yet the way the Heritage Act is written and the way the state functions is fundamentally about facilitating the smooth accumulation of capital. And essentially, the Heritage Act complies and fits with this model of addressing the issues with Indigenous heritage as obstacles to development, and how do you mitigate the problem of the obstacle. Now, I am pretty sure if you talk to the person who's the head of the archaeology branch or any of the various staff who work there, they would say that's not correct, that they have a very high degree of diligence and oversight engaged in that process. And I think it would be fair to say that within the way in which they structure and within the confined, hermetically sealed world they operate within, there is a modicum of truth to what they're saying. But when you step back and see this branch and see this legislation in its wider colonial structure, it becomes clear that the act, irrespective of their particular intents about the value of preserving scientific evidence, the net effect is an expansion of the colonial states working out of the process. Now we're going to read a little bit from Glenn Coutard's book, which explains in more detail the way in which the state is implicated in the colonial process, why it's a problem. I'm not going to rehearse that here. We'll deal with that a little bit later. So I'm going to ask you to accept at least my contention at this point, my assertion that the state is a colonial process targeted toward the smooth accumulation of capital. But the nub of the problem, the clear thing, is that within a market economy, the state, irrespective of political party and power, is charged with facilitating smooth, unfettered accumulation of capital. It's about, you know, framed in the way in which business and government often say, building jobs, building employment, you know, what's Canada's action plan? Or various notions where the government sees its role to make sure business can operate more effectively. And if we look at the way the process of environmental assessments are managed in British Columbia, and the way in which traditional use and occupancy studies and archaeological investigations are carried out, we can actually see some clear evidence of how the state sees its role or acts as a facilitator of business developments. If we just for a moment take a look at federal and provincial levels of environmental assessment, now these are ostensibly oriented toward the mitigation of potential environmental harm. But what is clear in the way these are framed is that they do not question development. Development is assumed. So You set up the environmental protection, you know, environmental assessment is about evaluating and mitigating environmental harm, but embedded with that entire mandate is the presumption that development is occurring. It's just not a questionable act. There is not a provision within the way these frameworks are set up to question development in and of itself. That is assumed as part of the process. The question becomes, how do you mitigate adverse effects? Sometimes the adverse effects are significant enough for the mechanisms of the act to kick in to stop the development. But it doesn't begin from the process of questioning whether the development is appropriate in the first place. Merely, it begins from the development is assumed, and then what are the effects? Mm-hmm.
I have a question about safety with the environmental safety.
Yeah. Yeah. Because under, so if you begin, so we turn to the Site C, Moberly Lake Nation, the First Nations concerns, and there's others also that are raised about that. Because the way the legislation is set up, the way Aboriginal rights and title are set up, if the government can, if it's deemed to be within the, to use the colloquial term, the greater good, that if the benefits for the wider nation, national interests are stronger than those of the particular First Nation, they're merely obligated to mitigate the ill effects of the intrusion, the infringement of that right. And so the law does not actually, under Canadian law, does not actually mean the government has to listen directly, do exactly what the First Nation asks them to or says they should. And nor does it give the First Nation a veto over. So the government say that they did have applied concern, and then they would provide a whole list of things from perhaps the claim is unfounded, the technical terms of their opposition are not merited, or that they're mitigating those through these particular programs over here. Now, that's not an argument to say that's correct. It's merely explaining how that process works. And because it is ultimately the way Canadian law is set up, assumes the Crown as sovereign, the final arbiter, the final holder of power. In Indigenous communities, the perception is that the Indigenous nation holds the sovereign authority. And that's the idea of the contradiction. And one of the notions of reconciliation is reconciling those two different systems. But essentially the way it's occurred is it's been reconciled under the British Crown, the Canadian Crown. Now one thing about the Heritage Act, it does provide a provision for agreements with First Nations to transfer the control of the permitting process to a First Nation, and there's a number of them. There's some agreements. There's a memorandum of understanding with the Hokomelem Treaty Group on South Bend of Vancouver Island, though that memorandum of understanding really didn't come into play when it, around the Grace Island issue, because the Hokomelem Treaty Group would be the group embedded there. But when I say it didn't really come, because it would have kicked into play the provisions before it escalated. There's an agreement with the gas industry. There's an agreement with Treaty 8 First Nations. But these agreements and the way the agreements are structured in the Act don't actually transfer decision-making in terms of the actual authority or jurisdiction. They simply devolve the authority held by the minister in the branch of the archaeology to a First Nation. And what it basically does is transfer the administration of the process. And these agreements, unless they've been negotiated in a way that changes or challenges that, essentially the First Nation who might operate one of these agreements is doing work that the ARC branch might themselves do, is following the procedure set up by the archaeology branch, and they're not actually fundamentally changing the process. Though the Act does allow for, the way it's structured, a possibility to go beyond simply managing the process set up by the government. So it's kind of interesting. There is the possibility but I think that given the way it's set up, very few of these agreements have ever done that, and the general direction of the agreement is merely a transfer of the administration, and all the rules are set by the province. The Chocolatin case, the Chocolatin decision, will actually have some potential implications on these things, because it actually has some language in the court decision about when provincial laws apply or don't apply in terms of treaty title lands, which are different than treaty lands. So I want to just talk a little bit about what I refer to as state-sanctioned destruction, which is what, I mean, I actually think a better name for the Heritage Act, this is a bit flippant, and this is a deliberately provocative term, it really should be the act of provincial desecration and destruction. Because even though it's ostensibly written about preservation, the key outcome has been the removal, the degradation, and the disruption of Indigenous heritage sites, given the way they're classified. If we simply labeled, for example, Indigenous burial sites cemeteries and applied the laws that govern cemeteries, the situation would be completely different on many of these places. This place here, of course, they haven't publicly released the number of human remains that they removed from the site. Has human remains that are actually buried. They're not just discarded, they're buried. They're placed in particular fashion. If that was a cemetery, the rules for just sort of bulldozing it out quite like that would not have occurred, no matter what. It would have changed the whole dynamic. Now, if we take a look at the forest industry in the 1990s in the north coast of British Columbia, there's a period of time in the late 1990s I thought it'd be very interesting to see these documents. So I went and tracked down as many of the archaeological reports that I could find for the North Coast Forest District, which is an area that comes roughly from the so-called Great Bear Rainforest up to around the mouth of the Nass River. It's a fairly large chunk of territory. And these are reports that were required in advance of logging and road building in the area. And there's three particular things that stood out to me. One, more than two-thirds of the reports. I mean, if you take each report, more than essentially two-thirds of each report were pure boilerplate. You know what boilerplate means? It's like a template. You basically cut and paste. It's cookie cutter. If you guys did that, we call it plagiarism. If you go online, you go to the thing, you cut it from here, and if you roll it from one of your essays to the next of your essays to the next of your essays, modest little change, that's academically dishonest. But you can understand to a certain extent in this industrial kind of model that you're going for, that how many times can you write an ethnographic overview of a same area and have it really be different? So that's understandable, but what happens is that these documents often got written initially, so each firm that was doing these things, somebody at the beginning of the day, say January 1st, 1990, wrote the initial Simpson ethnographic overview for the North Coast, and then each subsequent employee who's going to do a survey and write reports after that kind of cut and pasted from that initial review, and they rarely did any updates. And so that embedded and tracked through a whole range of oftentimes errors, misconceptions, and kind of sloppy writing. So about two-thirds of these things were basically boilerplate. The second point is most reports were work done quite quickly with minimal survey work actually conducted. Sometimes only involving a shoreline survey. Shoreline surveys are kind of fun. We do them. But what shoreline survey means is you get in a boat and you run along the shore and you kind of note things that might stand out. And I got to tell you, I mean, you can see some things. You get a practice eye. And if you do it at low tide, you can see what rocks and cleared and canoes, skids and things like that. But to be, you know, so that you get an initial look, it really is not very thorough. Because a lot of times you really do need to physically go ashore and walk and look. You can't see everything from the beach. And if depending upon the size of the vessel, if it's an open skiff, you can go a little bit close to the beach. But if it's a slightly larger boat, you're going to be offshore a bit. And so it's really quick and dirty. Some of these surveys did involve on-land, what we call pedestrian surveys, where they walk the site, but often they might do, say, one or two transects over what they thought was the most optimal line. Now, if you've done enough archaeological survey work, you can probably get a gut feeling for what is the optimal line to walk across the site. And so if you need to reduce the amount of time you spend doing something, you can probably get a good idea. You're not going to be 100%. You're going to be okay, sufficient. You know, it's going to be, quote unquote, good enough for the job at hand, but you're going to miss particularly hard to find places. About 3 days was about the median length of survey. And so some of these are pretty large cut blocks we're talking about. Quite a few that if you were really to do a classic survey of these areas, probably would take a week or 2 weeks to actually walk over them. And clearly the timber cruising guys who timber cruises spend a lot more time walking through the same space than the ARC survey guys looking for CMTs or other archaeological evidence. The third point is the surveys are primarily constrained to the specific areas of the cut block, the surveyed roadways, and the planned log dumps. Very few surveys mentioned or referred to areas of the intertidal zone, though there was an occasional mention of a canoe skid. Canoe skid is a space on a beach that has been cleared so you can bring a vessel, a small boat, or a large canoe in. They can range from anywhere from 6 to 20 feet wide, but they're really obvious to see because most of the beaches in this area are kind of cobblestones with rocks about this big or like this, and so you get these pathways that are completely cleared out. You go by at low tide, they kind of really jump out at you. And so you get a few mentions of these, but then you get these kind of perplexing things where you get canoe skids recorded but no actual village site noted nearby. And if you get 4 or 5 canoe skids, do not find a village, raises the question. One or two places I've actually gone to myself to look at, and what you find is because of the layout of the dump, log dump and the cut block and the roadway, they very carefully avoided going through where the likely village would be perceived. And the reason you get the canoe skid is because it's really obvious to see, or it's oftentimes might be nearby where the log dump might be. And so what that means is, since the contractor is required by the terms of reference to focus, they're only going to get paid for doing the things, and they are asked to look along besides, but there's a strong disincentive due to lack of time and expectations by the client side. They don't typically record the side-by-side things, especially in one case we went to where there'd been tons of CMTs recorded, but no village site noted. In order to find the village, you had to walk in about 100 to 150 feet inland and go through where a creek had cut through the overburden and then probe into the side of the creek. And then we found the shell that was left behind in the village and the evidence of the village. The only people who are really interested in that is somebody who's really interested in finding the material, i.e. an academic researcher who doesn't have time constraints placed in the same way, the consultant. The consultant, maybe on their lunch break, might do that, but you know, on the Northwest Coast, it's raining, it's miserable. Most people on lunch break, when you have to take half an hour out, want to have your sandwich, a hot cup of coffee, warm up a bit, then get back to work so they can get the helicopter ride back to the base camp. And it sounds, you know, but human beings, we move oftentimes, we're regulated by these very mundane, everyday things and the structures that limited us. Now, essentially what happens is that these surveys are kind of restricted. These state-sanctioned surveys, they're restricted by the conditions under which the contracts are let, and they essentially end up, through the restrictions, facilitating essentially unimpeded industrial development. And this leads to destruction of indigenous heritage. Some critics might suggest that I'm being overly critical and that there's ways to explain this, that it's maybe it's just bad research. We've changed since then. And there was one firm in particular who would be libelous of me to actually name, but many in the field are familiar with this. I mean, they've been absorbed by a larger transnational environmental organization now. But this particular firm was one of the most egregious, had the shortest surveys on the ground, had the most boilerplate in their reports. They often only had, say, out of a 15, 20-page report, maybe 2 pages, 3 pages that were actually unique to that particular report. Their time frames tended to be fairly narrow. Yet there was one report that wasn't commissioned by this firm in the same period of time that wasn't commissioned by a logging outfit. It was a private developer, and the detailed report was far more extensive. So the proponent, or the consulting firm, clearly had the capacity to do a more detailed, thorough report. And this other, this one-off report had rock paintings. It had old trails, assumed village sites. It was a very detailed for about, and it was 3 days of on-site visits. In another version where they did landmass that were about significantly larger, spent less time and found nothing. And there's these kind of interesting dynamics there. But I don't think that, really, I don't think it can be said that it's bad work or whatever. I actually think it's the constraints into which this process is confined. So the structure of the regulatory process and its reliance upon proponents, because of course it's not the government that's commissioning these studies, it's the proponents themselves, and they have fiscal measures at play in limiting how they do things. And that, so the reliance upon proponents that makes this the problem not bad research. So what we're talking about is a structural outcome of a colonial process intent on facilitating extraction. In the applied anthropology world, sociocultural world, consultants often, both tongue-in-cheek and slightly seriously, talk about what they call drive-by ethnography. Drive-by ethnography, what it is? Well, you've been hired to evaluate, to do an ethnographic study of 15 fisheries-dependent villages in the Aleutian chains, from the northern Alaskan Aleutian chain. 15 of these, you have 3 weeks to do it. So how are you going to do it? You say, okay, I got a checklist. I'm going to go into the community, and I got to count how many boats in the harbor, how many docks there are, do I see any people in the street, how many, what's the state of the cars, boom, I'm out of there, catch the float plane to the next village. Kind of drive-by ethnography. You've got the core of the method. You do get information that tells you something, but also because of the way it's collected, you can really, if you rely upon it, you can make some serious errors in judgment. If you're practiced and experienced enough, you can probably get a good gut feel that you're kind of on the right track, but that's different than thorough research. But the way in which these are structured as being industry-led, industry-driven, and the way the conditions are set up in the Act, it actually ends up under-identifying features to be recorded, and that in itself is the problem, which then reveals the kind of structural process where this is a colonial agent, because it's oriented toward really facilitating development, not truly preserving. And the point that I will end on to say, the counterpoint, which I'm going to have to pick up the next day to finish, but the key point of the counterpoint is that essentially maybe there's a way we can use the provision of the Act to create local First Nations direct control processes where we're not merely managing the government process, but establishing one that begins from the point of view of Indigenous rights. In order to do that, though, requires a kind of combined set of tactics. One, actually declaring it and having the willpower to do it. Two, engage in negotiation, which could be difficult if you've already declared you're going to do it. And legal action to try to find within the state's rules some legal framework which exists to do that. And that kind of balancing act between these three things has, over the history, proven the most productive in leading to reasonable results for First Nations. This combination between direct political action, government-to-government negotiation, and legal action or litigation, those three things together really become the kind of arsenal to advance the strategic interests of our First Nation community. And we will stop at that point today.